This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Benchmark Maps. When I travel down new backroads, there's always an element of surprise involved, from where to see the best vistas to how to find camping. Which is why when it comes to directions and road conditions, I like to go in with as much reliable information as possible. Benchmark Maps has been field checking their atlases for accuracy for over 23 years. They drive thousands of miles in each western state to assess road conditions and build the most comprehensive database of recreation points of interest possible. So when you start down a dirt road, you'll know someone from Benchmark Maps has already driven it themselves. And with so many other surprises in traveling, that's something I appreciate relying on. Learn more at www.benchmarkmaps.com and use coupon code SHEEXPLORES for 20% off your order.
This episode of She Explores is also brought to you by Sawyer. It might sound a little funny, but one of my favorite parts of camping and backpacking is filtering my own water. It's a moment to relax and rest, and it's when I feel really connected to the landscape that I'm hiking through. Sawyer makes a variety of water filtration products that are lightweight for backpacking. One of the most well-known is a Sawyer squeeze filter, and it has a lifetime guarantee, weighs just 3 ounces, and removes 99.99999% of all bacteria. We're excited to be giving away a Sawyer gift pack to keep you hydrated and protected in the outdoors. Head to she-explores.com/Sawyer or the link in our show notes to enter. Sawyer uses the best technology to keep you going regardless of your journey. Learn more at www.sawyer.com. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores. You might notice that this interview is a little longer than the others. Well, Sherry has a lot of experience as an entrepreneur in the outdoor industry.
I had that real reckoning with myself that here you are, you're 55, you have this life in front of you. What are you going to do with it? How do you want to do it? And what went right in your earlier businesses and what went wrong?
This is Sherry Tingey, and she's been using her mind for design to make gear people actually need in the outdoor industry for the past 50 years. Sherry is the founder of Alpaca Rafts, a company that manufactures pack rafts in Colorado, but she didn't get started with all that until her kids were out of the house. Her first company, designed by Sherry, was a ski apparel company based out of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It addressed the needs of athletic skiers like herself. Talking with Sherry, I noticed a lot of constants through our conversation, constants that we can all learn from, especially if you're interested in starting a business. She's independent, but she recognizes the need for a good team. She's on the lookout for problems to solve. I don't imagine she often describes herself as bored. Even when she was experiencing the debilitating symptoms of chronic fatigue, she stayed aware and curious. And now she's able to look back and acknowledge what went right and what could have gone better throughout her career. And she uses that knowledge to move forward. It was an honor to talk with Sherry, a woman full of experience and savvy. Sherry grew up water skiing in Arizona. She says she spent 15 hours a week doing it. And she went to college in the Pacific Northwest so she could start snow skiing. Upon graduation, she decided to head to Jackson Hole so she could ski more. This was the late 1960s, and there weren't a lot of people there yet.
So I chose Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It was the second year that they were open, and it really was a very kind of primitive wild. It was exactly what I was after. It was a great big mountain and nothing else happening. That's when I started my love affair with skiing.
Why are we looking for just a mountain and nothing else?
Outdoors is what drove me. Wilderness is what drove me. I'd been that way since I was a small child. I'd actually, some people would think, oh, this sounds horrible, but it was really a wonderful gift in a way. My parents, from the time I was 4 years old, my dad helped a gentleman that owned a very much a wilderness camp in Prescott, Arizona. Dad had helped him build cabins, and in return, we'd get to go to camp. And They sent me away at 4 years old for 6 weeks, and I did that for the next 10 years, Gail, 10, 12 years. And that was what drove my whole life. It set my entire life. I got to just play like this wild, crazy, who knows what out there in the woods. And I'd ride horses and hike, and we'd do long pack trips, and we'd be gone for 4 or 5 days at a time, even though we were, 7 years old, 8 year old kids. But it set who I was and what I wanted to do.
Sherry was fortunate to have a love of the outdoors fostered at a young age, which brought her to ski at Jackson Hole in Wyoming. She shared with me what the community was like in the late 1960s and early 70s.
If you look back, a lot of the outdoor industry started around Jackson Hole. Yvon Chouinard with Patagonia, John Sims, Sims Waders, LifeLink Poles, all these people. There were three hotbeds. There was Seattle, there was Jackson Hole, and there was Boulder, Colorado. And the Jackson Hole was an amazing hotbed of climbers, world-class adventurers, skiers, and people that, are at that level but were interested in creating and designing for this market that hadn't emerged yet. It was just this bare, it was the bare bones of it in those days. It was the perfect place for me to have started, because once I got there and eventually started making clothing for skiers, it just made sense. I was on my own, but yet there were several of us, quote unquote, on our own there. You didn't think twice about it.
And because there were fewer companies then, there were more holes in the market
No companies.
and no companies.
You know what there was, Gail, was Yvon had just started Great Pacific Iron Works. He was making pitons. The clothing companies in those days, REI existed. Jerry out of Boulder, a company, Holubar, made high-end mountaineering clothing. North Face was tiny. It was just coming into existence. As far as the ski industry, it was Roffey and Bogner and several European companies. The American market was totally in its infancy, and the ski market pertained to fashionable skiing. It wasn't utilitarian skiing clothing. So no, it didn't exist then.
Sherry wanted more utilitarian ski apparel, so she did what came naturally. Here's the origin story of Design by Sherry.
I didn't have much money. I had some Roffey pants and a Jerry jacket, and I remember I was just never very comfortable. This was the second year. In 1967, I worked in Jackson Hole that year, and I was working as a waitress and skiing. And then the next year, I went to Alta, Utah. I wanted to have a longer ski season, so I got what I thought was going to be a temporary job at the Wrestler Lodge there. My plan was to return to Jackson after the 1st of January. Long story short, I lost my job being a waitress because I had a dog and they didn't allow dogs in the canyon, and I wouldn't give my dog up. And you know how that goes when you're young. So I was out of work, and I looked at this ski clothing that I had, and I just hated it. And I thought, I can make something better. And in reality, I had been sewing since probably I was 5 years old. I started making my own clothing by the 5th grade, and I from that time forward, I made all my clothing. So sewing was something that was just second nature to me. And I went down to a fabric store, and I found some fabric, and I made up this suit. And once I made that up, people started asking me. It became this word of mouth thing, and I look back and I'm surprised at how quickly it caught on. There was a real need for very practical clothing, and there was a need for fun clothing. I unknowingly, just trying to make something for myself, this niche just appeared almost instantaneously.
So you really were just trying to make your ski experience more enjoyable.
I was trying to survive. Yeah, I was trying to figure, well, actually a couple of things. I found, very quickly, I was a horrible waitress. I hated it. And if you want to live in the mountains, especially in those days, if you didn't want to be a waitress, you had to come up with some way to support yourself. And for me, I was looking for something that was meaningful. And my entire life, I had been, my two great loves were one was the outdoors and the other was making clothing. It wasn't that I just had this sudden brainstorm that, oh, this is the thing to do. It just sent me there. And as I say, it first started, well, oh, I don't like this. I'm going to make myself something. And that's what I had always done. But once I did that with the ski clothing and people started coming up and asking me, I realized, oh, there's something here that I can do. I don't have to work for somebody else. I can make the schedule work however I want it to work. So I can spend my days playing in the outdoors and I can spend my nights sewing. That's kind of what came to me. And plus, I really did have this drive to create some clothing that would work. I just thought what was out there was horrible. So that drive just came in.
Was it difficult keeping up with demand? Was it always just you over the 10 plus years that you worked on this?
It was me for probably 5 years. And people understood that it took time. I usually was backed up maybe 6 months in orders. So it gave me this great year-round income, so to speak, or a way to, way to make a living, and allowed me this complete freedom to come and go. And yet I worked very, very hard.
After 5 years, Sherry started to add more women to her team of one. After another 5 years, she had six women working for her.
We all shared the same crazy love of skiing. We'd actually show up at the shop for about 2 minutes, head off to the ski area, go ski, and then be back in the shop in the afternoon and work till around 7 or 8 at night.
That's such a nice work schedule.
Oh, it was great.
Sherry's ski apparel was all made in-house. There was no outsourcing or mass production. It was one of a kind, something that doesn't happen a lot today.
So each one would have its own special embroidery on it. I never repeated it. So basically, you got a one of a kind suit. And that was the magic for me. Suddenly, people went, oh, okay. My suits weren't expensive. But again, you've got to find that place that you need to make a living and you need to find that who is the market that will buy. And once I did that, all those things sort of clicked together and people loved getting these one of a kind suits.
Do you know of anyone who still has one?
Yes, surprisingly enough, I moved to Alaska in 1981. So we left Jackson Hole. My former husband at the time was working for the Park Service, and we returned to Jackson Hole probably about 2005. He had a temporary superintendent's job there. Any rate, we, got together with all of our old friends, and I saw people throughout the valley. And I was dumbfounded. Most people have kept either their coats, their powder suits. So many people came up to me and said, I still own mine. It sits in the back of my closet. There's no way I'll give it up. Even if I'm, I can't fit it anymore, but I can't get rid of it. So a surprising number of people, yeah, still have them. It's pretty funny.
It sounds like a wedding dress.
Yeah, it is kind of like that. Okay, I'm done wearing it, but I can't get rid of it. And I think it had to do with that they were one of a kind. And each person developed a real attachment to, whether it was a suit or a coat, they really developed an attachment to it.
So you said that in 1981 you moved to Alaska, and that's when you stopped working on Design by Sherry.
That's right. At the same time, my ex worked for the Park Service, And we had an offer to go to Alaska. And about that same year, I had gotten really sick. I was one of the early people that contracted chronic fatigue. In those days, they didn't quite know what it was. So working was pretty tough for me. So those two things together was this chance to go somewhere else. I ended up selling my business to a couple of gals that worked for me. And yeah, we headed to Alaska.
We'll keep talking with Sherry after a quick break. This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use the time that you usually go to the post office doing what you love. If you run your own business like Sherry or myself, time is valuable. I really cut back on our She Explores shop earlier this year because going to the post office took time away from producing this show. I'm excited to be using Stamps.com now because it means I'm able to print postage to ship products like logo tank tops and stickers, all without leaving my home office. I can use that time to create podcasts or go for a trail run and clear my head. With Stamps.com, you can access all the services of the post office right from your desk. Head to Stamps.com and use code EXPLORES for the special offer of a 4-week trial, which includes postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the radio microphone on the top of the homepage and type in Explores. That's stamps.com, enter Explores. This episode of She Explores is also sponsored by World Nomads, the global travel lifestyle and insurance brand for independent adventure travelers. Whether you're 100 miles from home or on the other side of the world, Colorado or Cambodia, Oregon or Oman, World Nomads covers over 150 of the activities you love while enjoying the great outdoors. The greatest thing about them is their passion for supporting travelers who want to get off the beaten path and explore their boundaries. Learn more by tuning into the World Nomads podcast. Hear about great destinations and the amazing nomads who continue to explore those places. Like Sarah Puckett, who explored the remote islands of the Western Philippines aboard a traditional wooden boat while on a 20-month honeymoon. 20 months! The World Nomads podcast. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and Spotify, or go to worldnomads.com/podcasts. We're back with Sherry.
The thing that was the most difficult was I couldn't sew.
After 10 years working on Design by Sherry, Sherry is living in Alaska and suffering from a then-mysterious illness, chronic fatigue. She found that she had just 3 hours in a day to be productive, and it was really hard for her. But she stayed curious and kept creating in her own way.
And I was so frustrated with it. And what I finally found out years later, once I got to the person that really saved my life and saved my health, often what happens with chronic fatigue is it destroys your adrenal system. And if your adrenals aren't functioning, most of us who work in creative fields, you don't casually create. And I'm absolutely that way. Boy, when I start going on something, I'm 24/7 and, you know, I won't sleep for 3-4 days and I quit breathing. I quit, you know, whatever you need to do to get your project going. And you can't do that with something like chronic fatigue. And I couldn't figure out how to not create that way. So I had a real battle for several years of every time I would sit to try to sew and create in sewing, I get so sick all over again that I couldn't function. So there were several years that I just hung it up. But one of the things that when we moved to Alaska and that I found that with a chronic fatigue that I could do, as crazy as it sounds, I could run dogs. And we moved into a small cabin and we developed about a 30-dog team. We dog sledded all over the state. That piqued my interest. Most of the clothing for, especially for serious dog mushers, was just kind of non-existent. It was a great way for myself to get back into building clothing. That one of the difficult things when I started to try to do anything involved with skiing, you know, so many memories flood in. All you remember is that you can't do this anymore. You all the things you could do, and now you can't. And that anger that comes in, it really hobbles you. Whereas for the dog mushing, it was a whole new start, if that makes sense. I didn't have to compare myself to who I was before. It was like, well, Sherry, you start here and you do what you can do. And I could develop that clothing at a much, I forced myself to learn to control myself, and to control how much effort I put in and to be able to walk away from that project. Whereas before, I could never walk away from it. And building the dog sledding clothing, if I got tired, I taught myself to stand up and walk away. So it became a very important thing for me. It was a great learning tool, and I, again, it got my juices flowing, and I just loved doing it. And I would have mushers all over the state come and get clothing from me.
It sounds like that was a really good lesson for you to listen to your body and take a step back when you need to, because like you said, when you're a creative person, when you're someone who's self-starting, it's hard to do that, even though you know you should. But when you actually physically have to, did it become more of an ingrained behavior for you?
Oh, it you're absolutely, I mean, it was the best lesson I could have had. It was a lesson that I needed to have in order to survive, because I don't think I could have lived through being the person that I was before, going at the pace that I went before. I couldn't do that. And I've never since been able to do that, and I probably shouldn't have done it then, but that's life. This allowed me to just train myself and to force myself to be something that I had never been in my life, and one was to be patient.
Sherry lived with untreated chronic fatigue for 17 years, staying active while conserving energy, running dogs, raising her kids. She finally got proper treatment and began to feel like her old self again.
When you have something like that and your health comes back, it's this incredible gift. And you can't take it for granted, and you cannot do to yourself what you did before. It allowed me to start physically doing things at a much higher level than what I had before, but I still, you're never going to be the person that you were before something like chronic fatigue hits. But I could do a surprising number of things, especially if I built up to it. But I knew that in particular that allowed me to get back into design of outdoor gear, which is what I really, really love to do.
It took Sherry a bit to jump back in.
I was fishing around trying to find a place to start again. I'd been out of it for 17 years, so to speak, except for making the dog sledding clothing, which somehow it wasn't quite the same. And I'm not sure why I felt that way, because I mean, it was the same, but in my mind, it wasn't. Trying to fit back into that bigger scheme of what I wanted to do in the outdoor industry, I kept looking, but I couldn't quite get it there, Gail.
Sherry started a couple of different ventures, making patterns for outdoor gear, designing a line of children's outdoor apparel, but none of it felt quite right. Would you say you're someone who you trust your intuition?
Usually I do. I would say every time I have not trusted my intuition, it's been a big mistake. If I choose to listen to it, it's pretty darn good. I think, I think the patterns would not have been a mistake. I think at the time it was for me. I had lost my confidence in myself to be able to produce. I think that's part of why I just couldn't. I got everything ready, but I just couldn't face that. Can you put this out to the public? Are you ready to accept it if it's a failure? Are you ready? All of those questions. And I think at some point, each of us has to go through those questions when you return from being absent for a long time, especially when you lose your trust in what your health can do, or what your body can do, or what your brain can do, and all of these things. You go through that period like, well, can I restart? And I think I just wasn't ready to answer all those questions yet. I was getting there, but I just wasn't quite quite there.
But you were ready when you started Alpaca Rafts.
That was about 2 years later. Yeah, I was. Even though I should back up a little, even though I wasn't involved in sewing outdoor clothing for those 17 years, with the exception of the things that I did and stuff for my family, I never lost my interest in it. I always had my eye as to what was going on. And I had felt for many years, all things are very cyclic. And outdoor clothing went from the times when I was making it being this very utilitarian, technical, and lightweight, so to speak. It changed those early years when I was first sick. And I kind of call it the people started carrying the whole kitchen and the kitchen sink with them when they went backpacking. The tents got fancy, the clothing got fancy, your cooking gear, everything got fancy, it got big, it got heavy. And some of these packs that I used to go in for a week with a 30-pound pack. People were carrying 50, 60, 70-pound packs, and I always thought, this is nuts. This is just, you don't need this kind of stuff. But I sat from sidelines and watched this. And then just as I was starting to get better was when the ultralight revolution came in, and a guy named Ray Jardine, he was really the forefront of that revolution.
Sherry read Ray Jardine's guide, Beyond Backpacking, that revolutionized how people packed for the trail. Sherry was watching as the industry swung back in a direction that interested her, and just in time for her son Thor to provide her with the inspiration for Alpaca Raft. When Thor was in his sophomore year at Colorado College, he won a Rick Kellogg grant to take a 5-week trip through a portion of the Alaska Range. Sherry explained pack rafting to me, especially as it was defined back then.
I didn't invent pack rafting. Alpaca invented modern pack rafting. But the concept of a pack raft has been around for years and years and years. But, you know, if you go back to World War II, the Army pilots evacuation rafts. Some of the crazy adventurers around the world use those little bitty rafts to start this idea of pack rafting. And that idea had really taken root in Alaska because you've got all this land and all this water and no way to get across it, you know, unless you got a float plane. So pack rafting had been, this concept had been brewing, and we put Thor in contact with Roman Dial, who was a friend of ours. And Roman had suggested that he do this trip that Roman had previously done. I think he did it a couple years earlier, and to get some pack rafts. So Thor went to Walmart and bought what was called Sevler, which is a wonderful, actually, they're a wonderful boat company. I believe they're French. They make all kinds of boats, inflatables, but they made a little thing called the trail boat, and it was $69.95, and it's just designed to float 5 feet off of shore on a lake. Well, Alaskans being Alaskans, they buy these things and they try to run rivers with them. And of course, the boats just aren't built to do anything like that. And they just explode usually within a mile. And so you get to the shore and put 2 pounds of duct tape on it, try to go another mile. And it really was more of a survival exercise than anything else. And so anyway, I back this up, and Thor, his sophomore year, wins this grant, and five of them do this trip in the Alaska Range, and they each took these Sevlers. And they had a fabulous trip, but the boats were just a complete disaster. And Thor came home for that trip, and he said, I'm never, ever, ever, ever taking this boat to do something like that again. I've got to find something different.
Thor won a second grant to travel 600 miles through the Brooks Range in Alaska. He bought another inflatable boat that wasn't much better than the trail boat. Sherry helped him reinforce it because she had the energy and she couldn't resist using her hands to solve the problem.
I was just interested in this project. You know, even with the chronic fatigue, I skied carefully, but I skied. But what I had been more than a skier was kayaking was equally important in my life. I actually brought the first whitewater kayak into Jackson Hole. And kayaking was what I really couldn't do when I got sick because I couldn't afford to swim. When you have chronic fatigue, your muscles don't work that well in cold water. And I couldn't, you could never, it would be horribly irresponsible to ask somebody to watch out for you if you dump, that, well, I can't get myself to shore. Would you kindly get me out? You can't do that. So I, except for flat water and very gentle water, I had to give up kayaking. But so I'm watching these pack rafts from the side going, this is really interesting.
After Thor's trip, he shipped the pack raft back home, and Sherry couldn't believe the state it was in.
We unwrapped this thing. It's been in this box for 5 weeks. It had left for the start of the trip at about a 3.5 pound boat. And that boat probably weighed over 14 pounds when we unwrapped it.
Wow.
It was patches on top of patches on top of patches. And it was still soaking wet. And I unroll this thing and I look at it. And that's when Thor literally said it. He said, Mom, can you build me a boat? And Gail, I looked at that, and it's like you say, your intuition. All of a sudden, these little light bulbs started going ding, 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 ding. And I wasn't putting it all together, but I think it was that magic moment in life that my own body knew I was well enough to do this again. I was healed enough to do this again. And that pack raft represented everything I ever cared about in the outdoors. Because pack rafting is this wonderful meld of water and land. You're hiking, you're boating, it's weight, it's, and I, of late I'm doing all the studying about ultralight packs and, tents and clothing and whatever. Well, a pack raft is the epitome of one. It falls down that same line. If it weighs too much, you're not going to carry it. The only thing that was missing for me was I'd never worked with inflatables before. But everything else was like, oh my God, this is everything I've ever done and cared about dumped into one little thing that, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what I'm doing, but I can do this. Here it is. This is what you've been waiting for.
So what was the learning curve like, teaching yourself how to build a pack raft?
The real learning curve was inflation. Well, the thing that's surprising with inflation, let's say you're a sculptor and you work in 3D and you imagine a boat or you imagine whatever you want to imagine and you see all the shapes and you think, oh, this is great. And you can make all these shapes, you can sew all these shapes, you can build them. However, when you put air to it, you put inflation, it all turns to a ball. Everything goes round in inflation. So all this great stuff that you did just disappears into this ball with these funny little things sticking off of it, whatever it was that you thought was this tail or who knows what. And that's the great shock in the beginning. You look at this and go, oops. That's suddenly where you come in. Okay, you have baffles, you have this, you have. There are all these things that you do learn to do. So once you get that down, then the game gets pretty fun. At that point, it very quickly crystallized in my mind, Gail, that I said, I want to build a boat that is close to a kayak as I can get it. It's not going to be a kayak, it's inflatable. There's no way. But if these things are going to run rivers, I want these to run rivers well. And so that was mine side, the side that all the other guys were coming in. This thing has got to be bombproof and it has to be lightweight. And so I had those three things, that performance, as light a weight as I could get it, and just as tough as I can get it. Those are the three things that we hammer in our heads every single day in this shop. Everything that we look at, everything we build, those are the parameters that guide us. It's never left.
So what was the response like when you had a prototype that you actually introduced to the market?
I started working on the boats. It would have been in October of 2000, and I had, oh, probably three boats ready to go, ready to put in the water by March. So those first three boats I built, I took it off of the boats that were available. And the second we got them in the water, we saw the advantages of the things that I'd come up with. But what was wrong was they were all too short. People never even thought about the size. And of course, here's the problem. Every time you add length, you add weight. And so we were trying to cut these down as short as possible, but they couldn't run rivers decently. So those first three boats, I immediately lengthened about 4 more inches, and bang, there came that basic boat. That boat, I had probably 7 or 8 testers out that summer. And by the fall, we had come up with that we really liked what we had. The people that were testing them loved the boats. I didn't let them out to a lot of people, but I let them out to the people that I knew who were really serious about, pack rafting and had been at it for a while. And Thor and I kept playing in them. And after the end of that summer, August, we went, this is right. Now we got to figure out how to make these things.
Alpaca Raft incorporated as a business in the fall of that year. In December, Thor, Sherry's son, went off to do what you do after college, find yourself. Up until then, they'd been working together, but it was the right move for both of them.
He was at that point of he needed to go grow up and find out who he was in the world and whatever. And I needed to find out that I could do this again. And those were two very different goals in a way. So he headed back to law school and became a lawyer, and I ran Alpaca. So that made it all the more important for me because it was just me. I had that real reckoning with myself that here you are, you're 55, you have this life in front of you. What are you going to do with it? How do you want to do it? And what went right in your earlier businesses and what went wrong? I got this great chance to start over as far as all of those things. You don't often get that. And here was this blank slate in front of me again, like, well, here's your chance. What are you going to do that makes it really right this time? What matters to you? How do you want to market? How do you want to manufacture? All of those things. And I sat down and made that list with myself. And one of those things that was always at the top of it, and I'm not, everybody has their own choice of what they want to do, but for me, I've never wanted to be somebody who manufactured in Asia and brought stuff in for many, many reasons. But it just wasn't who I was. What I really loved was manufacturing it myself, but I also at that beginning realized that I couldn't manufacture these boats myself in the beginning. I just didn't have the money to do it. So I had to find another way, and that's why we started through Jack's Plastic Welding and then through Feathercraft. But as that 5-year mark came, several things just came. Again, the universe has its way. It dumps it all out in front of you. One, I realized I did have a niche. There was a niche. And it was a huge niche, no, but it was a very viable niche. But the only way to be able to make money to actually survive in this is if you do your own production, Gail. Let's say you make 400 boats. That's not a living if somebody else has made them for you. You can't mark them up enough that that you can make a living on. The other thing was that in spite of having both companies that built my boats, you're going to have production problems and you are going to have quality control problems. And the only way you can really control those are if you do it yourself. So both of these things had come together that I realized that one, I could do it, and two, that if I really wanted the quality that I wanted and wanted to be able to change however I wanted, I had to take over the production. So I had decided on that this was okay. And about that same time, my sister, who lived in Phoenix, and my mother at the time was 90, My sister was killed in a car wreck, and that left me. And for me to live in Alaska with mom at 90, that just wasn't real. It was my turn to be closer. So I knew I needed to be closer to her. I also realized that Alaska is not the place to manufacture. It's you're shipping all your stuff up there, and then you're shipping your stuff back out. You're adding a lot of costs. So all those things just kind of came together and said, Sherry, you're going south. And I ended up here in Colorado. Once I got down here, my brother-in-law came up, and we hired one other person. We started in just in a small little workshop, and we never looked back. It was what alpaca was waiting for. Those first few years got my name going. People loved the boats, but once I started building the boats, then I could do whatever I wanted, and it's been amazing.
I know you talked to me before about the fact that the bigger you get, the harder it is to stay cutting edge and to really innovate. Do you plan on alpaca rafts always staying small?
I think we will always stay small enough that we're in that innovation. And it's so fun now that Thor and Sarah are here. He's just all over that, Gail, and he absolutely sees that as well. You can't, it's who we are. I've been having so much fun these recent months because now he's CEO and he's got a great design mind too. I get to play with all my design stuff, and we have been upgrading everything. And I don't see us ever stopping that because I particularly know with pack rafting, one of the fun things is, as I told you earlier, we didn't invent pack rafting, but we invented modern pack rafting. The concept of what a pack raft can do today and all the different kinds of things you can do with it, and actually we have several different boats now, all these places that it can branch out. There's no, even if you wanted to copy, and I hate copying, but even if I wanted, there's nobody to copy. It's just us. It's a blank slate out there. It's what can your mind come up with? What can you envision? What can you create? And it's wonderful.
So you were really shaping what pack rafting is.
What a pack raft does now, and the concept of what a pack raft is and what it can do are so incredibly different than what it was when it started. If you go back to those early days of pack rafting, a pack raft was a tool to add water to your adventure in the most basic sense of the word. I guess the easiest way to say it's a different way to look at a map. If you look at this map and you see all these mountain ridges and valleys and drainages, and lakes, rather than looking at all those blue lines on that map as, oh my God, how am I going to get over these things and through these things? Those become trails, the same way that the ridge line, the trail that may already be there, it adds water to that way of traversing through the wilderness. That was the original concept of the pack raft. And looking at that, the people that used them, they were hikers, they're climbers, they're mountain bikers, they're hardcore adventurers. That pack raft was a way to either get them to the climbing area, to get them across the wilderness, whatever. People never said, oh, I'm a pack rafter. Well, fast forward about, oh, maybe 2008 or 9, you started hearing people say, I'm a pack rafter. So it changed from it being this tool for your other adventure to the actual pack raft is the adventure.
That's Sherry, innovating and defining a sport. I went way over time chatting with her. There was just so much to learn. I asked her one last question. Is there anything that you would change looking back about your journey as an entrepreneur, making stuff for, 50 years?
I would change. Probably, in the light of all of it, probably not. Even the illness, as much as I'd like to say, oh, hope I never have to go through that thing again, it taught me things that I needed to learn. I think the thing about being an entrepreneur, and I can only say for myself, working in the outdoor industry, is be really honest with yourself as to how good you think you are. It's very easy for all of us to go into this, oh, I've got this fabulous idea. And sometimes you do, and people will just knock you down and knock you down, and you have to keep going till you find the right person to help you get where you need to go. Other times, maybe it wasn't such a great idea. And I think there's that, you keep that openness in yourself, you can be honest about that. If you know your idea is great, you just hang in there. You stay in there and you'll find it. But if it isn't, for God's sakes, change it. Don't get too stubborn.
That's definitely something you've shown throughout the course of your career. You've been flexible and you've tried lots of different things.
You have to. Yeah, you absolutely have to. And again, that for me, that was the greatest gift of getting this chance in older age, Gail, to do it again. I can't tell you how amazing it was to be able to put that all back out on the table and look at it from the perspective of, that didn't work the first time. This didn't. This did. What do you want? And even down to how do you treat your employees? Who do you hire? What do you do? What is value? What is and it's something we should do from the beginning. And most of us don't. We just get caught in the, oh, I'm an entrepreneur and I'm going to build this. And that. You aren't thinking, I'm not saying that for everybody, but very often they get caught in that entrepreneurial spirit and forget that I don't care who you are, you didn't get there by yourself. It's not a one-man show or one-woman show, one-person show. And whatever idea you have that you bring to the market, you're using people to get it to that market, and they have to be valuable to you. You can't abuse them. You can't underpay them. You can't all of these things because you need them. And to say they don't count is just baloney. That's the lesson that when I came around that second time, that like, wow, we go through these entrepreneurial times that we put so much glorification in that entrepreneur that you forget them. No, yeah, that person's important, but they're not there by themselves. So that's my feeling.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you, Gail. I hope that was halfway decent.
Sherry, I don't think you do anything halfway, but thank you for the laugh and thank you again for the time. Sherry continues to innovate into her 70s. Learn more about Alpaca Raft by visiting their website, alpacaraft.com. Head to our landing page via she-explores.com to see photos of Sherry's original ski apparel designs, family snapshots of her time in Alaska, and pack rafting. Thanks to our sponsors, Benchmark Maps, Sawyer, Stamps.com, and World Nomads. Links are located in the show notes and the episode landing page. If you enjoy She Explores, you'll probably enjoy our sister podcast, Women on the Road. Hosted by Laura Hughes, it's filled with stories of honest experiences of life on the road from the women who've lived it firsthand. Find it where you're currently listening to this podcast. And if you enjoy listening to She Explores, please take the time to review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It'll help other people find us. Even better, share She Explores with a friend. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, so make sure to tag us so we'll see it. It always makes my day. Until next week, catch up with us in our She Explores Podcast Facebook group. There we talk about recent episodes, give each other advice, and share resources and more stories about our time in the outdoors. Music is by Memory Palace. Music is also by Lee Rosevere, Kay Engel, and Steve Combs via the Free Music Archive. Until next week,
Have fun out there.